time of my life. Ey, I never felt this way before.
Zeitpläne erstellen, passende Teammitglieder zuweisen oder Risiken in zahlreichen Projekten erkennen. Monday Sidekick versteht dein Business, denkt voraus und packt mit an. So arbeiten Work-Management-Plattformen heute.
And I owe it all to you.
AI you love to use. Jetzt testen auf monday.com.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Warum warten, bis das Jahr vorbei ist? Beim Black Sale von Edubilly gibt's jetzt bis zu 30% Rabatt auf alles. Von Whey-Proteinen über Kollagen bis zu Vitamin- und Nährstoffboostern. Nur vom 24. November bis 1. Dezember und solange der Vorrat reicht. Du bist kein Fan von Tabletten? Dann sichere dir jetzt unser 2-für-1-Angebot auf EduOne. Der All-in-One-Drink mit allen Nährstoffen, die dein Körper braucht. Nur bis zum 1. Dezember auf edubilly.de. Und jetzt viel Spaß bei deinem Podcast.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. It's nice to have you with us. When did I talk to you last? On Thursday? God damn, this schedule I'm on is like, I'm loopy. I'm exhausted. But a lot has happened. There was a presidential debate or a shit show of some kind. I'm sure something's on fire. It's very hot somewhere. There are people unhappy and yelling and dying and without homes. The water is rising. All that's going on right now as we speak. People are being massacred. It's all happening. I didn't watch the debate. I didn't need to. I knew what would happen. I saw bits and pieces. And I don't care who you are, what you think or what team you're on. We're all in trouble. We're all in trouble. But what am I going to do? What am I going to say to change anything? I don't know. Might make some of you feel better. Might make some of you pissed off. But ultimately, what does it do? Am I just part of the era of yammering? Am I part of yammering culture? Am I just going to argue and bitch and, you know, get angry and pretend like I know things? Not today. Not today. Kind of loopy today. I shot a night shoot on Friday. I didn't get to bed till 4 in the morning. I got up at 7:30 to get a plane on Saturday. Did some interviews, an interview Saturday. It's Sunday I'm recording this, and I'm still not quite right. Not quite right. Today on the show, I talked to Paul Scheer. He's a comedian, a writer, an actor, co-host of podcasts How Did This Get Made and Unspooled. Just wrote a book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma. And in the book, he mentions that the first time he ever publicly talked about the stuff he wrote about in the book was when he was on WTF back in 2010. And we're going to play a segment of that for you before this conversation. I think it's important. I'll be in Tucson, Arizona at the Rialto Theater on Friday, September 30th. Then I'm in Phoenix at the Orpheum Theater on Saturday, September 21st. You can go to WTFpod.com for tickets. Martin Mull passed away on Thursday at 80 years old. His daughter said he died after a long illness. He was on episode 971 from November 2018, where he talked about his comedy, his music, his art, and more. A lot of stuff. That's available for free in all podcast feeds, episode 971. And look, what have I been doing? I've been working and watching documentaries. I watched all 6 episodes of that Hitler documentary, and a lot of good information. The narrative was good, but it is a great example of why reenactments are fucking terrible. Now, look, I don't mean to begrudge the guy that played Hitler in the reenactments. He put a lot into it. You know, he got his hair going. He was moving his arms around a lot and yelling. he did all right, but it was 80% reenactments. And they should have just made a mediocre movie about Hitler. But the information was good. And I actually didn't know the arc of some of that stuff. And it's very disturbing. Obviously, there's ways to see where we're at now in this country as something foreboding in relation to the possibilities that Hitler opened the door to. But I had a very odd moment. And I'm not sure I can explain it. And I'm not sure it'll come out right even. But, you know, I watched that whole thing and the arc of racial hate and anti-Semitism. I knew most of that, but I didn't know the build of it and how all these other Germans had, you know, run the thing. It's one of those things where, you know, who did Hitler actually with his own hands kill anybody? Maybe his niece, but somehow he was the driving force of the massacre of millions and millions of people and the deaths of millions of Germans. And anytime you watch that guy or anything about him, the depth of depravity and the scope of evil is so fucking overwhelming, it's hard to even wrap your brain around. But there was an interesting moment where it just happened to me after watching that entire thing, and it was towards the end. Spoiler alert, Germany loses and Hitler kills himself. But shortly before that, towards the end of that last episode, he gives his dog, the dog he loved, he gives it cyanide to see how it works. That's the way this film went with it. Hitler just kills his beloved dog. And it was at that moment, for some reason, in my mind, I'm like, what kind of fucking monster kills his own dog for no reason? That was the moment. I'm like, well, Hitler, and he killed half of Europe. But it was the moment of the dog. I'm like, this guy is a fuck. The dog, unreal. And I'm a Jew. Okay, look, here's what we're going to do. This first part you're going to hear of me and Paul, this was from November 2010, so a little more than a year after we started the podcast. And in his new book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, he says the DNA of this conversation is throughout the book. This came from episode 124, and this is what happened after about a half hour of comedy talk when I was convinced Paul was a pretty well-adjusted guy. Just a note before you hear this, Paul didn't identify his stepdad by name in his book, so we're going to remove it from this older talk as well. Here, listen up.
I'd always seen you around, and we never really talked, and then when we did, I liked you, but you seem very well-adjusted, so I don't understand that.
You would be surprised.
Yeah? Like what?
No, I have demons.
Yeah?
I have demons.
Really?
Mom got divorced 3 times when I was a kid growing up.
Yeah?
Yeah, that was a little rough. We lived a lot in small apartments and moved around Long Island. Right. I remember I had one stepdad who refused to let me call him by his name. His name was He made me call him Daddy, which is, in retrospect, weird. but the craziest thing, I'll be embarrassed that my dad is probably going to listen to this, but my dad got into a fist fight with my stepdad in front of me
which
when I was a
stepdad?
Kid. Stepdad 2.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was crazy. As a kid, to see, like, your real dad and your stepdad, like, fight, go for it. I was young. I was 9 or 10.
What was that about?
Do you even know? I remember seeing it. Like, my dad and I had come back from apple picking
watching videos and going to New York
just
City.
Just loving it. My dad and I went to a Martin Lawrence concert at Radio City Music Hall.
Yeah.
Run Tell That. And we were like in the center, the only white people at this Martin Lawrence concert. I was like begging him, we gotta go see Martin. I brought my dad to Def Jam comedy. Like, he came. My dad was a good trooper at all this stuff. But
you're a big hip hop guy.
I just, you know what? As a kid, I was like, I didn't know. I loved, like, I don't say black comedy, but I know, like, that was like a thing. Like, I loved Eddie Murphy. I loved Martin Lawrence. I loved that show. And so I just was like, Def Jam, yes,
yeah.
I want to see that. And then and we'd also go see George Carlin every single year in New York City and go see his shows. And
it's good, dad.
Like, yeah, he was the best. So they got to this fist fight, like. All I remember
back
is this,
from apple picking, back from apples.
Back from apple picking, sitting, coming in, seeing my stepdad, who's in a bathrobe. My stepdad was a truck driver for a supermarket, you know, and my dad came in, and he goes, "You don't say fucking hello to me, Bill." And my dad's like, I said hello to you. It's your fucking fault if you didn't hear it. Then all of a sudden, my stepdad picked up a coffee mug, fucking wailed it at the like my dad's head. My dad ducking it, exploded on the wall.
Then
all of a sudden, like they just went at it like a grappling thing around my kitchen table. My dad's the most nice, you know, well-adjusted guy. And then all of a sudden, apples are flying. So like I'm throwing apples, my dad is throwing apples, and they fight out until they like literally leave the house, like outside the front door.
Oh, no.
Like that kind of fighting. My dad's a pharmacist. And again, like, you know, and my pharmacist fighting a truck driver. It was like something like out of a Clint Eastwood movie. It was like boom, boom. It was insane, insane stuff. You know, that was like, yeah. So
how did that resolve itself?
It resolved itself very cheesily, which was like hours later, I got on the phone and I was on the phone in my house and my dad was on a payphone. And they apologized to each other while I was in the middle. Like, you know, because I could
for
be
your
like,
benefit?
Yes, for my benefit to hear them apologize.
Like
to each other.
They all decided, probably on your mom's instruction, that
yes.
This wasn't a good thing for the kid to see.
Exactly. So they had to, like, get together and apologize over me. So looking back on that, that was pretty terrible.
Do you remember being upset? What was your reaction? Were you crying? Was it like,
oh, yeah. I mean, it's.
It was all just chaos.
It was chaos. And also, like, crazy because it's like you're watching your dad get into a fight. And
did
like,
you
I
like the guy?
I didn't
Bill?
Like this. My Bill, my dad loved. My stepdad hated him. He was like an abusive fuck of a dude, like a terrible.
Oh,
dude.
Your dad is Bill.
My dad is Bill. Yeah,
and your stepdad was,
and he was just an abusive, bad dude. But yeah, you know, he'd come home like literally an arm in a cast because he got into a fight with you know at like work. You know, like
did he beat you up?
Yeah, like a little bit. I mean, like I say it very cavalierly, but yeah, like I mean, we would get into some fucking
I can't even
fights.
Imagine.
Like
I can't even imagine that.
Like I lived on a farm, and like we had horses and dogs and stuff, and like I would talk back a lot. Like that was my thing. And
that's what comics do.
Yeah, and so that's like
that's how we find our voice.
Yeah, I got into a lot of. I was talking to like people this weekend. I was like, I got into a ton of fights all until like eighth grade, and I was like, oh. I got to stop
this. Did you win?
Yeah, because I was fighting a 40-year-old guy at home. Like, that's why I was getting good at it.
It's so funny. Out of all the people in the world, I would never assume you were a scrapper.
Oh, God. Big time. Like, I... because you fight this big fucking 40-year-old dude, this fat dude who's strong and, like, literally, like, throwing a pitchfork at me. Like, and dodging a pitchfork.
Get the fuck out of here.
Oh, yeah. Like, getting locked up in, like...
Well, I can see why your mom loved him.
Oh, yeah. It was crazy. Like, my mom, I think, rebelled in the most crazy way. Because my dad's so nice and great. And the man she's married to right now, also wonderful and great. But it
finally
was,
got a good one?
Yeah, and I think it was just sort
number
of like...
Four?
Number four? This is number three. This is number three.
Oh, so the first one...
First one was my dad. Then it was this guy, and then it was this guy that she's married to now. So I moved to three different houses.
Right.
But there was dating involved in there, too.
So you're saying that okay, so was like your mom's fuck you to your dad.
Yeah. I think that she didn't. She was like, I want something different. And she got something insanely different. You know, like it was a crazy.
Threw a pitchfork at you.
Oh, and that's not even the worst. I mean, like, but I, because of that kind of style of fighting, I think I never realized how strong I was. So, like. When I was in...
the dodging pitchfork style?
Yeah, well, like, it was like, you know, you just learn to be, like, more of a grappler, you know? It's like, you know, a lot of, like, just slaps and runs or punches in the stomachs and runs. And, but when I was in sixth grade, I got into this fight with this kid, and he, like, gave me, like, a sixth grade punch, like, boom, you know, a punch in the face. I remember this is ninth grade, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I grabbed him by the neck, and we were by a car, and there was, like, a car fender there, and I was like, whap! Whap, like his face into a car fender. We were both suspended from school, you know, and because he started it, I got to go back and he got kicked out. But it was, but like that kind of like, did not realize like that's, I was fighting for a much, you know,
You're going for the fucking money. Did they have to pull you off him?
I remember that was the time where like my knuckles were bloody from just like punching.
Oh my God.
That was a rough, I was a bruiser as a kid.
Fucking idea. Paul Scheer, badass.
But I stopped. Fuck? I stopped that.
You had to give it up?
I had to give it up.
Went to comedy.
Yeah. Just turned it into a different direction. Yeah, I couldn't. I remember, like, honestly just being, like, I think at one fight when I was a kid, and this is, like, an early, like, 10th or 11th grade, being like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't like this.
Well, like, how the fuck you? I mean, it must have been some sort of crossroads. Thank God you had your real dad there. You know, you could have ended up just a fucked up kid.
Yeah.
I mean,
for sure.
I mean, what led to that decision?
I think that my dad came every weekend, so he was able to kind of take me out, and we would go every weekend. We'd go and do something fun, so it was like a break. And he would also come like every Tuesday and Thursday, I think, to my house and like hang out. So I saw my real dad a lot, and I think that was a good relief. And then my mom kind of wised up at a certain point. And she's like, "Oh, we're out of here."
Yeah.
And
the guy's throwing a pitchfork at my kid.
This guy has more guns than he has shirts. You know.
Holy shit! Hell, how'd she shake him? That sounds like it would have been hard to shake that guy.
This is you want to hear how we shook him? This is a crazy thing. My mom created, she pretended that he won a trip, a hunting trip. She like created these envelopes and was like, "You won this trip." And
she did the layout and everything?
She did everything, and she got him plane tickets, got him a hotel, and created this whole like fantasy 7 days away from him. The minute he left the house, a moving truck pulled in, and we got all of our shit out of the house, and we took off. And we moved into a small one-bedroom apartment or two-bedroom apartment, and just that was it.
So he comes back, and
he comes back. The house is empty, and then he found us at a certain point, and that was weird. But, you know, it was like he was on his best behavior at that point.
Didn't she have to get divorced and everything?
Yeah, she had to get divorced, but it was sort of like, that is where I'm a little foggy on how that happened. Like, I'm just seeing it as a kid and being like, okay, we're moving all of our stuff. Let's get out of here.
Oh my God.
You know, and, you know, so I didn't know how all that shook out. But yeah, then my mom started dating him for a little bit. Like, they went on a couple of dates and, like, one of his.
Before the divorce to see if it would still.
Yeah,
Steve. She got some boundaries. And
exactly. And, you know, thank God that didn't stick. I remember as a kid thinking to myself, like, oh God, please. And, oh, you know, the worst part about it, too, as a kid, I was relieved. Was a born again Christian.
Yeah.
Like born again Christian to the point where my mom got rebaptized in a big pool, and the pool's in the front of the church, and everyone speaks in tongues.
And you were there? You
know? Oh, I spent.
How old?
Oh, God, for like 3 or 4 years.
But like when ninth I was like, grade? Or
No, like probably like fourth to sixth grade, like in that area.
So you had to go to a born-again Christian church?
Oh, for like hours on a Sunday, like hours and hours. And it was like, everyone's like, and the Lord said, speaking in tongues, and like people are getting healed, and it was crazy. And like my parents took away, my mom took my Weird Al Yankovic in 3D album and broke it over her knee because a song was on there. It was called Nature Trail to Hell. And it was on one of the devil worship lists that like the church had given them. Like, if your children have any of these albums, and one of them was a Weird Al album, you must find this and destroy it.
She destroyed it in front of you.
Yes.
And
that
what'd you do?
And my LL Cool J album.
Oh shit.
Yeah. And, it was terrible. I was crying like, no, my Weird Al album. Like,
did you ever tell Weird Al that story?
I did, actually. I got to tell Weird Al that story, which was awesome. And a great full 360 there.
Oh my God, how'd he respond?
He just thought it was insane because the song is called Nature Trail to Hell in 3D about going to a drive-in to see a horror movie called Nature Trail to Hell in 3D. Like, there's nothing satanic about Weird Al Yankovic at all. Like, in the greatest stretch of the imagination. But, like, you know, and I'd listen to In Excess, and my mom's
but
like,
that might be Satan.
It might be.
You never know. They're
you
very
never know.
Cunning. He's charming.
And that's it. That was
very
Weird Al.
Funny, yeah.
Satan comes in Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But my mom, like, took all my action figures away and gave me, like, Ten Commandments figures.
On,
like, I had like
on.
I had Moses, like literally a Moses action figure, and he had like two tablets in his hand, like the Ten Commandments.
Oh, come on. You're kidding me.
Oh, no.
What'd you do with those action figures?
I would play with them like I would play Batman or G.I. Joe. Like,
flying
just
Moses?
Around. Yeah, like I would. I would like make them like, I'd make Moses like swing down a pole and change and get into a Batmobile. I had still the Batmobile, so Moses drive a Batmobile. Like,
he still had a job.
It was crazy.
You put Moses in the Batmobile?
Oh, it was insane. You know, like, that was a dark period. Like, I think coming home to that house and my mom my mom's still on a religious kick watching Jesus of Nazareth, which was like a 12-part documentary of, like,
yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and yeah, like, yeah. Watching that, like, over and over. That was her Saturday nights, like, watching that. And
oh, God.
Just, like, my mom is become better now.
And you go up and put Moses in the Batmobile.
Yeah, and just drive around. What am I doing? Like, you know, just terrible, like terrible times in my household. Yeah,
that is fucking grim, dude.
Oh yeah, it was a dark time.
How did she come out of it?
I think that it really was. I mean, you know, whatever. I say it cavalierly now, but it was dark. Like, there was some points. Like, I don't know if I saw everything that my mom experienced back then, because I was away on the weekends. I think that's when it got rough. I mean, I remember many times us going to hotels and stuff like that. But bar none, I think this is the end of the beginning of the end for us was there was a loaded handgun in our house. And I remember having my mom held a hostage with a handgun and seeing that as a kid.
What, during a fight?
During a fight. And that was I remember going, what is going on?
That's
as a
horrifying.
Kid. And as a kid, I can say it now and I go, wow. Like, even thinking about it now, I'm like, wow, that was crazy dark. That's insane. But as a kid, it doesn't register. I don't think it's what's going on?
Well, do you just
on?
Probably sense that your mom's in danger?
Yes. And that was
it's
I remember
horrifying.
Like,
you must have just been crying all the fucking time.
Yeah. And I remember saying to my mom, we got to get out of here. My mom's like, no, it's okay. It's okay. I was like, we got to go.
Oh,
we got to go.
Did he hit her too?
Yeah, he hit me, hit her. I mean, but you know what? Never to the point of we never were hurt. So I think that was that was always my kind of, line. We don't have broken arms, or we don't have this, or we don't have that.
Was there some party that felt bad for him?
No.
He wasn't.
No, I thought of it.
He didn't cry and apologize and fucking, you
he
know.
Would apologize, but he was he was an older brother instead of a dad.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of relationship. So it was a lot of I think he was competitive for my mom's affection towards me, which is insane. It's that's a mother and a son. That's not you're a husband. And, you know, so it would come out a lot in Indian burns, that kind of stuff, which would really hurt. But I do remember calling we called Child Protective Services at one point, and they came to the house and they interviewed our parents side by side. And they were like, does this happen? And my mom's like, no. And they talked to me and I was like, yes. And they're like, oh, well, the kid's lying. The parents are telling the truth.
And then did she get beaten for that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Like, there was crazy. I mean, it was
the gun thing, though. So that, shortly after your mom designed
that was
a hunting trip?
Yeah, I think it was about roughly that time.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Who's she married to now?
She's married to a great guy, this guy, Walter. Awesome.
And you get along with your mom?
I get along with my mom very well. We actually have a better relationship now.
How do you think you managed to not get as fucked up as many people in that situation? Aside from fighting, you decided not to fight anymore because your dad's influence. But I mean, holy shit. I mean, you're a pretty fucking pleasant guy.
Well, I think, thank you for saying, but I think I had a good escape back then, though, in a way. I feel I don't know. I love TV and movies, and I really got into
Moses
comedy.
Moses and the Batmobile.
Yeah, Moses and the Batmobile. But I really got into movies and TV.
And the
I
comedy
think
was a real reprieve.
Comedy, yeah. I listened to Smothers Brothers albums. I had all my dad's old Smothers Brothers albums, and just it was just fun to kind of sit and hear that. And I remember even reading an article, I think it was a Smothers Brothers article, where I think they had some messed up parents. And
right.
I was and I remember going oh, okay, well, that's cool, because maybe they had messed up parents. I have messed up parents. Maybe that it evens out. That's what I'm if I want to do this, I have to have that. Or,
I think there's something that I've experienced is that I never quite understood why until, as I talked to more comedic performers that, when you think about doing comedy and you're coming from that, that you're really thinking about doing something that might have been the only thing that made you feel better.
Yeah.
And that you can't really think of what else you would do.
Yeah, I think you're right. I remember as a kid, I was all I wanted to do was do what Eddie Murphy does. I want to be like Eddie Murphy. I want to be like Eddie Murphy. And I would just sit out on my front yard and act out sketches and just talk
did you
to
know,
myself.
Did you know Delirious?
Oh, yeah. I watched Delirious on HBO. We didn't get HBO, but back when cable was old, you would have you could hear, but you couldn't see. And so that was
that weird half station.
Yeah.
You watch.
Yo, so I would watch Delirious listening to Delirious.
You saw half of Eddie Murphy.
Just
and then,
going in and out. It was something that had, it was just and I just remember watching that and tears just streaming down my face going this is the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. Like,
yeah.
Boogie in My Butt and like those albums. And I got away with a lot because my dad, I think, would buy me these albums, not realizing how dirty they were. Like, you know, like.
But did you have to hide them at the other house or did you keep them at your dad's house?
I kept them in my house and I just listened to them in my room. Like, no one would come up there to see what I was listening to. So they didn't have like stand-up comedy tapes weren't on those lists. So I could have my Billy Crystal, You Look Marvelous album and like listen to that and like listen to Stephen Wright.
They didn't have an effective way to dramatically destroy tapes.
Exactly, right. So,
records you could break.
Just, yeah, these, like, they couldn't do anything. Yeah. So yeah, it was all like Bill Cosby, Emo Phillips, Smothers Brothers. And, you know, it was like, it was great. Like, I just remember, like, and I didn't listen to music when I was a kid, so I only listened to comedy. I think maybe that's a trick, too. Like, I would never go to my room and be like, I'm listening to music. I'd be like, I go to my room and listen to albums. Like
headphones?
Andrew Dice Clay. Yeah, put on those and just sit there and just be like, yeah, yeah.
And just laugh by yourself?
Yeah, and then.
You had siblings or you didn't?
No siblings, and wherever I lived, I had nobody lived near me. No kids lived near me. So I was always alone in the neighborhood, and there was no kids to play with after school. So it was, like, always comedy. And, like, I would, so sad, I would take, like, Running Scared was this, like, Gregory Hines, Billy Crystal movie, like a buddy comedy.
I remember that, yeah.
And I would take my tape recorder and put it by my TV and tape the movie on cassettes and then bring those cassettes, like, with me on my bus to school and be, like, listening to, like, movies like that. Like, listen to full movies, like albums. So,
that's
like,
amazing.
Yeah, so I did that. I
think you didn't have friends?
Oh, I had friends. I always seemed to get like I got popular at certain points, but I was always a nerd. Like wherever I went, the first 2 years I was a nerd and an outcast, and then the last 2 years I had friends.
What was your nerd focus? Was it just comedy, or did you do other shit? I mean, were you a good student?
I guess I was an okay student.
No Dungeons and Dragons.
No Dungeons and Dragons. I think I was just like. In my own world. I think I was a little bit more of like a...
An outsider.
Yeah, like a kid who would be like drawing and then someone would be like, hey, and I'd be like, what? Like that kind of like... But then I remember like I was making out with this girl in sixth grade and that was like, I was like one of the first kids to make out with a girl in sixth grade and like that was, that ascended my popularity for a little bit and then immediately like the next year I went to like a new school and then I was like back down in the dregs again. Just, you know, like, I had it. I had it all. Now I lost
back,
it.
Back amongst the people.
Yeah, just terrible.
Again, that was from episode 124 with Paul Scheer in 2010. So I listened to that conversation with Paul before having this new one. So this is now, like, it's almost like a part two. It's like a follow-up to what's happened with his life since he first started dealing with what happened to him as a kid. Okay, so... Now we are with Paul, current day. His new book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, is available now wherever you get books. Here we go. Me and Paul, a few weeks ago.
AI had the time of my life. AI never felt this way before.
Zeitpläne erstellen, passende Teammitglieder zuweisen oder Risiken in zahlreichen Projekten erkennen. Monday Sidekick versteht dein Business, denkt voraus und packt mit an. So arbeiten Work-Management-Plattformen heute.
And I owe it all to you.
AI you love to use. Jetzt testen auf monday.com.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Like, it's been 14, 15 years.
15 years since we have done this.
It's crazy,
dude. It's nuts. Because I feel like I see you, I'm a fan of yours, I listen to the podcast, watch your movies, and I see you at Largo all the time. But yeah, when I looked at that today, I was like, that's...
I know we see each other around, but we're not in each other's lives, per se. But what I was going to say is you don't look any different. It's the gift of the baldness.
I talk about that all the time. Bald men don't age. It really does. It, you don't see that much. It's great. You suffer early on when you're in your 20s and bald. Yeah, but, you look at it and you're like, ah, that poor son of a bitch. But then when you get in your 40s, it's like, all right, it all evens out. It all comes back. Yeah, bald men are, that's the one thing I can say to bald men. Keep it short.
Yeah.
And don't worry about it if you go bald.
Yeah,
early.
It's kind of amazing. You look timeless. So and as soon as I grow my hair out, which it is now, because I have to go do this role and I want to give them options.
Right.
So I leave all the hair I have.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then like build the guy.
Right.
Yeah, but most of the
time. You don't get nervous about that. Like you don't get nervous like walking around with a look that is not your own.
What, after?
Just like while you're shooting it.
I've kind of sucked it up. You know, like I've one time I did a no mustache.
Okay.
And that was weird. But, you know, it was me and it was kind of a welcome change.
There's, when I was on Black Monday, the show I did with Don Cheadle and Regina Hall. And,
oh yeah, that was a good show.
Super fun show. Yeah. So in the second season of that show, my character was on the run. So I just shaved off my beard and have a mustache, just a mustache.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got to tell you, the looks that people gave me with just a mustache.
Different?
It was different. It was a different vibe, especially when it was coming in.
Yeah.
Like, once it got to its full potential, people are like, I like the mustache.
Yeah.
But the growing in part is the part where people are like, you might be a pedophile. Like, there's something about it.
You're projecting a little bit. I mean, I think we get invested in this stuff. I don't when I get very hairy, I look very old and disheveled.
Right.
Because all the gray comes out. But like if they cut all my hair off, it's all right.
Yeah.
I want to keep the facial probably. I don't know what they're going to do. I don't, you know, but most of the time I get there, they're like, we're just going to leave it. And I'm like, well, make me something else.
I like the idea that you can transform into a character. You want them to do that. You're like, yeah, let me get
I know,
in.
Let's do it. And they're like, but we kind of like this. I'm like, ah, fuck. I just want to look different. Like on Glow, that guy just had a mustache and he had that hairdo. And that was enough. That was enough to go on.
But it feels like when we watch like these great performances, like people have totally transformed. But you look at Adam Driver, he looks the same in every movie.
A lot of them look the same.
Yeah.
You know, Brad Pitt, give or take, looks the same.
Just
Clooney, occasionally some stubble.
Stubble, that's all you're going to get.
But these are stars. I've let go of the idea that I'm going to be a transformative actor. Like if you let me commit to a jacket or some pants. Like I don't think Sam Sylvia changed his pants in the entire seasons of Glow.
When I was on Fresh Off the Boat, I never wore a different shirt. It was always the same shirt. And it's like, I looked forward to that shirt. And I love that shirt because it was a Kenny Rogers brand shirt. So for a short period of time, Kenny Rogers was manufacturing shirts.
Oh, I miss that. Why did that stop?
I don't know. It was a good looking shirt.
Yeah.
He did chickens, did shirts. The guy was a talent.
At that. I don't know, man. How do you feel about acting these days? Good?
I feel the same way that I always feel about it, which is I'm happy when I get to do it and someone wants me to do something in their thing, but I can't expect someone to want me to do anything. I think everything that I've done.
Like I looked at your thing because I'm like, I'm going to catch up, see what's going on, take a look at the Wikipedia, and it looks like you've done 1,000 things.
I try to work. I try to create my own stuff. I try to just be busy, you know? But that's... I feel like you just have to keep on hustling, right?
You got all these producer credits. What's that?
I make some shows.
You make shows?
I make shows. I mean, we produced, I made Human Giant with Aziz.
Well, that was way back.
But that gave me at least a cachet to say, I've made a show.
Right.
Right? And then I got a chance to work with Adult Swim because I got to make my own show over there, this NTSF SDSE.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then that kind of begot more things. You know, like if you can do something and deliver and be on time and be a nice, reasonable person, you can produce. And I feel like...
You've done network shows?
Yeah, I did a Fox show called Party Over Here with the Lonely Island guys. And we had an all-female sketch show with Nicole Byer, Allison Rich, and Jess McKenna. Super fun.
So it's sketch. So it's your area. You're not just producing procedural.
I'm not going to be like... I'm not doing like New York PD or something like that, you know? I'm not going into that world, but it's like, but I think you know this too. It's like doing this, doing the podcast, doing all these things.
Yeah.
You want to have your hands in it. I want to have some control.
Right. Yeah. But I don't look for the other work. Like I'm good with the podcast. I'll do the stand up. They want me to act. So I resist it, but I don't ever sit around and think like, how can I make myself more overwhelmed with work?
I look at it more like
if I'm not getting work for myself, I can't expect anyone else to do it for me.
Sure.
Like, if someone brings me something, great.
Yeah.
But 90% of the stuff that I feel like I get is through personal relationships.
Yeah,
right? It's like I can't just go in and expect, okay, I can get this audition. Here we go.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't even think about that. But I guess for me, doing this show and the stand-up, I'm like, I'm good.
Yeah.
How much... I don't need to produce much more. I'll play some music here and there. And I'll show up for these acting things occasionally. I'm very resistant to acting.
You are. You see, but you are somebody who was completely embraced as soon as you started acting. Yeah. I feel like when you were
on Glow. Done a few things.
Yeah, and it was great.
I think I think they see me as a type. I mean, like, it's not like I'm 60. I'm a cranky, kind of intense, sensitive Jewish guy.
I can see you perfectly on Young Sheldon, the spinoff of Young Sheldon. I could put you in anything. This is the perfect age. When you get to 60, this is where the world opens up because everyone's dropped off.
Well, yeah, I'm going to start getting all the Judd Hirsch parts when he drops dead. Can you turn up the Jew a little? But in the book, you talk about that story about... whatever that weird tour was or whatever.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. So when my dad and I visited L.A.
How old were you, though?
I was in sixth grade. So I don't know what I'm always bad at, like, remembering what it made, 11?
Yeah,
right. And I'm in sixth grade, and my dad and I go out to L.A., and we read in one of these guidebooks, the best thing to do in L.A. is to go to Hollywood on Location, which is this... little office in Beverly Hills.
Still exist?
I don't think so. I would imagine.
It seemed like a great racket because they're just getting the rundowns that anyone could get.
Yeah. You go, you pay them $75. Yeah. They give you a photocopy printout of everything that's shooting in LA exteriors.
Yeah.
And that's it. And they just send you on your way. You just go. You could
hang around
wherever you want.
Yeah.
And that was a time where, I mean, if you were a stalker, it's a perfect, I mean, it told you who was there. It's like, okay, Highway to Heaven, Victor French and, and Michael Landon will be here.
I think it's relatively public information, isn't it?
I think so. I think if you're smart, you could figure out like who pulled permits and what is it for. Sure. And I think that's why they started changing names. And that might have been part of their...
On the little placards for what's shooting? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that may have been what they were offering if they had different placards.
Right.
But we went, my dad and I, we went and we saw Michael Landon. And this is a time where... you would be near a set and you could just, I have a picture of me standing next to Michael Landon as he's talking to his DP, like directing a shot with a cigarette in his mouth and like framing up a shot. And I'm like, how the fuck am I that close to this? Like you would never get that close. Yeah. But they just, every one of these productions, these people would just bring you in. So I met like David Carradine and he signed an autograph with like a yin yang symbol. And, and I'm meeting Marky Post and I went on the set of Simon and Simon.
Yeah.
And then we end up at this movie Communion. And I don't know what this is. And the security guard approaches us and says, you want to meet a celebrity? And I'm like, yeah, I met a bunch today. And he's like, but this is the biggest of them all. And I'm like, oh, who is it? And he's like, Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
Now, as an 11-year-old, I have no idea. I'm not watching Deer Hunter. Yeah. I'm not watching Dead Zone.
Right.
And my dad's like, no, you know him. He's the bad guy from the James Bond movie. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I want to meet this guy.
Yeah.
He goes, all right, hold on 1 second. Guy walks in this, like, walks away, comes back out, and he's like, all right, Christopher wants to meet you, but no camera, no parents. And I look at my dad, and my dad's like, do you want to go? And I'm like, yeah, I want to go. So I give him my camera, and this guy takes me across the street, and we go into this abandoned warehouse. And he kind of opens the door. I walk in, and he shuts it behind me. He stays outside, and now we're in this dark-ass warehouse, like a little bit of light peering in through like the doors.
Yeah.
And then from out of the darkness comes Christopher Walken. Now, again, I'm not super familiar with him at this time. And he's in this movie where he is communing with aliens. So it's an alien movie. And his face is pasty white makeup and it's like sparkling and he's wearing like these contact lenses. So seeing this image just come out of the darkness, I was like, I'm the kind of frozen. And he's like, hello, little man. And he touches me and he's like, do you believe in aliens? And I go, yes, And he's like, yeah. I do too. We're making a movie about aliens. And I'm like, oh yeah. And he's like, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to be an actor. And I don't know what I'm doing at this point because he's talking to me. Like I've gone over, Michael Landon just signed and I walked away. Like and he's like engaging me. And then he gets down on his knees and he puts his hands on my shoulders and kind of looks me in the eye. He goes, don't let anyone tell you what you can or cannot do. And then, like, signs my autograph, and then releases me. And like, and as if on cue, like the door opens, the security guard comes and takes me out. And I'm like, I don't even know what happened here. But it was like forever burned in my brain. Like I had this meeting with Christopher Walken, and I would tell people like I met Christopher Walken. I didn't even feel like I knew him. And as I got older, I'm like, oh my God, that's the craziest thing.
Yeah.
But I always remembered this man in this white face just grabbing me and telling me, don't let anyone tell you what you can be.
Oh my God. Now, have you run into him anywhere?
Never. And I don't want to. I don't want,
you want to keep it pure?
Because there's something so great about that. It's in my mind, it's like, I can't top it. So it will only go downhill. I'll be like, I met him again. And he was like asleep in a chair. And
Just so funny at that, in that era, like it's such an abstract kind of like, you know, Michael Landon and Keith Carradine. They were on television.
Yeah,
then.
Exactly.
And it was, these are, you know, they're trivia question answers.
100%.
You know, Walken is still, you know, vital to a degree and notoriously himself.
Just an interesting guy who you're like, of all the people to meet, that's like, that was the best one of the day.
I remember when I was growing up in Albuquerque, they were shooting the movie Convoy.
Okay.
It was Sam Peckinpah's, last movie.
Yeah.
It was not a great movie, but it had everybody in it. And I remember we found out they were all staying down at the Hilton, and I just started hanging around. I met Ally McGraw. I met Ernest Borgnine. Ernest Borgnine.
That's what I want.
Dressed as a cop, a sheriff of some kind. I'm trying to remember who else I met. I met Peckinpah. I was trying to get pictures with them.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened to those pictures. But you could just walk around and do that.
And it felt like everyone was cool with it. Like, that's what I'm saying. These security guards or LAPD officers, they're just like, oh, come here. You're a kid. Come
a
closer.
Kid, yeah,
you know, and it's like, and
kid.
get, you know, when I was a kid growing up, my dad and I would go to a bunch of basketball games at Madison Square Garden. And I could just walk right into the press rooms because they're like, oh, well, he's clearly a kid of somebody.
Yeah.
But we're not going to stop a kid.
Yeah.
And I would just walk behind the scenes. I met basketball players. I did everything just because I can't believe my dad let me just go off and walk. I was like, I'm going to go wander. And I just would get in and find my way back. But yeah, I met like Patrick Ewing and stuff in a hallway just because, again, no one's going to stop a kid.
And there was different, like, I remember I was in Vegas. I can't remember. My brother was a big tennis kid.
Yeah.
And there was some invitational there. You know, sadly, it might have been Bill Cosby's.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a big tournament. And, like, Bjorn Borg was there, John McEnroe. These are my brother's heroes.
Yeah.
And we're just walking around the courts, grabbing pictures.
So
nobody was around.
And no one was there to protect you. By the way, I do have a story in that book, too, about Bill Cosby, which was... same thing at Madison Square Garden. We're watching some college basketball.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, I put this in context because I think a lot of people now, you know Bill Cosby for everything that's gone on in the last, you know, decade, right?
Sure.
But when I was a kid, this was he was the king of all men. He was the Cosby Show was huge. It was like a show I love. I taped it every week. And I see him down there and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to go talk to Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
And I go down and I wait for a timeout, you know, in the game. And I just really approach and go, Mr. Cosby, can I, you know, I have an autograph? No, nothing. Not like, I wasn't even there, like a ghost.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Mr. Cosby, hi, Mr. Cosby. And he's just staring forward, but there's nothing going on to watch. So he's just zoned right in the front. And I don't know, I'm a young kid. I don't know that to take this as a fuck you. Like, right. So I just kind of, then I'd start standing there awkwardly next to him, just waiting until he turns around. And then his head just turned almost like a bird's head, like where his whole body stayed center, but his head just turned and he was like, go. And I was like, okay. And I just got the fuck out of there. It's the scariest thing. Like, go. And it still chills me to my core because as a kid, this was the nicest guy of all time.
Yeah, those are the heartbreakers.
Yeah, and it was just like, and not even like, I'm not signing autographs. It was like a straight up ignore and then go.
Yeah, there are people we know that do that.
I have such an issue with this because I've seen friends of mine do this thing where they won't take a picture. But by the time they get done explaining why they won't take a picture, you could have taken five pictures and been done with it. Because it's always like, hey, can I get a picture? Oh, sorry, I'm not taking pictures. And then the person's like, oh, wait, what?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm actually not taking pictures right now. Oh, really? Just come on. For me, nah, man, I'm not going to take a picture. Like all this back and forth and it's like, just click. There you go. You got it.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's a boundary and I can understand it if it starts, sometimes depending where you are, it could start a flurry.
100%.
depending on who you are.
Right.
Especially after a show or something, if you're trying to get out or you just wait till it's just stragglers.
Yeah.
Even if you take one, then all of a sudden you just see them coming back in.
I feel like I'm always down for it because I think at the end of the day, I'm like, the only reason why I'm able to do any of this is because people listen to stuff,
watch
stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I do it. And some part of me just kind of like, I lock into some different mode.
Right.
Where it's not exhausting, and I just do it.
And again, we're not Denzel Washington, of course. Right? So it's like
some guy in the truck said, "Hey, Mark Maron, can I get your autograph?" And I'm like, "Isn't a picture easier?"
Yeah, like autographs seem like such an old school
what
thing.
What are you going to do with a piece of paper?
Put that up on a wall. I remember I bought an autograph when I was a kid. I was so excited. I saved up my money to buy a Quentin Tarantino autograph.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and what am I doing with this? Like, it's not even one that I got, so I have no personal connection.
Well, you could have become one of those guys that hang around in the back doors of places. You know those guys? You ever go to you go to the airport and there's five of them there? And they, no matter where you go, it all looks like the same guy. It looks like the same group of guys.
And those guys are not the nastiest, but they can be the most aggressive because a lot of the times they're making you sign a
blank
photo sheet. And I'm like, okay, I'll sign two. Like, come on. And I'm like, I'm also like, you're not making any money off of these. I don't even know what the autograph trade is.
I don't even know what it is either. It must be some sort. I'd like to know more. Why doesn't someone do a doc on those guys?
Because it's like,
are they trading them? Are they competing? Because I'm not making them any money.
No, I get baseball cards. I get like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But like autographing a picture, I've looked on eBay because I had the same. I'm like, maybe you're going to get $8. Maybe, and that's me, but it's like, you're not going to get, it's not a windfall.
Yeah.
Maybe
they got faith in you. Maybe it's almost like that. It's like you're gambling.
Right.
Like, I wonder how much this is going to be worth in 2 years.
Right. If I do something really messed up, it would be worth a lot. Like, hey, I got a, what's the guy who played Beretta?
I got a Robert Blake,
all right, this is good.
I sent away, I knew a kid in junior high that used to collect autographed pictures and he just sent.
I did that.
Yeah, I did too. I remember I got Buddy Hackett's.
I love it.
Got Buddy Hackett's signed picture. I got a Mae West signed picture.
Whoa, these are great. I got Steve Martin, Paul Reiser. I got a David Letterman. I got a couple of these.
Yeah.
And they're great. Like you just send away and it was so fun to get it. It felt like, whoa, someone's reading this mail. Like, the fact that they were like, even that celebrities are sending 8x10s, like autographed 8x10s is a kind of a crazy idea.
What happened with Alan Alda?
Oh, so this is when I'm a kid, I am with my grandma.
Yeah.
My grandma and her bridge friends, and we're sitting at this restaurant in the Hamptons, and there's Alan Alda at this other table. Now, again, Alan Alda, I like him a lot more now, but as a kid, MASH was a boring show to me. Like, I wanted to watch Different Strokes. I wanted to watch, Silver Spoons, Happy Days. Like, MASH was a, I don't know why MASH was a bummer. Maybe it was a theme song. It was not my show.
Yeah.
And my grandma's like, go talk to Alan Alda. And I'm like, I don't want to. She's like, go, you got to talk to him. And I'm like, I don't really even know him that well. And she's like, go. So I go and I approach the table and I go over and I wait for a break in the conversation. I'm being polite. Because they're having lunch, and I go, Mr. Alda, can I have your autograph? And they, and he goes, no, just no, I immediately, that was the first time I've ever been rejected, especially as a kid. Like I didn't know you could say no,
right.
And I wasn't expecting that no. I was like, and I'm now stuck, and I start walking away. And he's like, you know what, actually, kid, name three things I'm in, and I'll give you an autograph, and I'm like. Now I'm stumped, and now everyone at the table is kind of laughing because they're watching me like fumfer. I'm like MASH, and then he cuts me off. He's like, not such a fan, and I'm like, and he's like, okay, and sends me on. It didn't sign me an autograph or anything. Just sends me on my way back, and I just was mortified, right? Like he just shut me down so hard. And then my grandma's laughing so hard, like, ha 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 ha, you idiot. I'm like, I didn't even want to go. I didn't want to talk to this guy. And I've heard everything I've heard about him is he's a lovely guy.
He's a lovely guy. But I'm sort of surprised by that story.
I think what it is, and this is my gut, is that he probably caught that this table of women were like pointing at him, looking at him, and then force this little kid on him. Because again,
why not hurt the kid?
I'm not watching. Yeah. Well, yeah. I guess that's the other side. Yeah, I'm not like watching four seasons. Yeah. And I will never forget that image of a table full of adults like thinking this is the funniest thing. And I had this other moment. This actually makes me think of this. I grew up in Long Island.
Yeah.
You know, it's outside of New York. It has a very unique energy to it. It's kind of jockey, but it's kind of like working class too. There's an energy to it that I just can't find anywhere else. And I went out to my cousin's communion and we were going to this Italian restaurant afterwards.
Yeah.
And at this point, I'm very early on in my career. I don't really have that much there. And,
yeah.
And this guy, you know, is automatically threatened by me. Like, you know, Paul's a comedian. He does stuff. He's like, oh, you're the guy's comedian?
Yeah.
This guy's a comedian? And then like starts like, give me a joke, you know, and that whole thing. I'm like, I don't really do that. And he's like, and then whatever happened in that interaction, I got put in a headlock by this guy. He's like, you're funny?
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is a fucking waiter, maitre d' at this restaurant who's now has me in a headlock at an Italian restaurant. Just because I am there and I am in comedy and I didn't know what I was like sweating in this weird way. I'm like, I don't even know how to get out of this. Like, I don't know if this is proving that you're funnier than me, that you now have me in a headlock.
What's the point?
I was like, I don't know what just happened. And like, I just left, just shell-shocked. Like,
felt a little humiliated.
Yeah.
A little like traumatized.
Like, why am I being bullied by
what are you supposed to do with that? You know, I mean, are there comedians that go like, I got one for you?
Well, this is one night I went out and Russell Crowe had the head of MTV invited us out for dinner, Human Giant, all of us. And we're out for dinner and Pauly Shore also came. And, you know, so Pauly's at this table. I've never met Pauly Shore before. And we're all hanging out there. And then Russell Crowe walks by the table and he's like, Pauly. And he comes over and then Pauly just kind of like negs him like, I don't remember meeting you, man. And he's like, what? You don't remember meeting me? We were on the talk show. We did this thing. We did this. And he's like, nah, man, I don't know. And then makes Russell get more amped up. Like, come on, we did this. We did this. And he just pulls over a chair, does a move that I've never seen anyone do in my life, where he like waves over to the maitre d' and goes, that's too bright. So the maitre d' gets up on the table, unscrews two light bulbs above our heads. Yeah. So now we're in the darkness that like, and then we just start sitting with him and he finds out that we're comedians and he goes, tell us a joke. And then we're all like, we don't have jokes.
We're not that kind of comedian.
Exactly. And he goes, all right, you know what? I'll tell you a joke. And then he had jokes and it was like, the punchline was like, Jesus wasn't giving the sign of the cross. He was just trying to swat away a fly. He's like, that's a joke. And we're like, oh, yeah. He's like, all right, so give me a joke. And we're like, we don't all have him. He's like, all right, here's another one.
Yeah.
And he had them locked and loaded, ready to give us like a million jokes. And was so mad that we didn't have it. And then for a while, I kept like, five like street jokes in my phone, like just in the notes app. Like, if I'm ever in this situation, I'm gonna be like, okay,
yeah,
here it is. Because I couldn't bear dealing with that
I've
anymore.
Got jokes, but like, and I can tell street jokes, but it always seems like, provoking.
Yeah.
It's never sort of like, I want to hear the funny guy tell a thing. It's like, what do you got?
Yeah, impress me right now. It's like, it would be like, you know, like saying it like, you know, LeBron James, like, all right, shoot a free throw now.
Exactly.
Yeah, show
me. I mean, that's even easier.
Right. I guess you're right. Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? Where's the ball?
Right, yeah.
The worst that could happen is you miss.
It's like, but there's like this thing where it's like, prove it. Well, I can. I don't know if I can prove it. There's nothing to prove.
I went to a high school reunion a couple years ago. I don't know how long it's been. It must have been my 90.
Was that fun?
No, it wasn't great because it was, it seemed to be arranged by exactly the kids you didn't like in high school.
Yeah.
And it wasn't everybody, and it was a weird mix, but I knew most of them. But like the organizer, one of these women who, you know, wasn't close to in high school. Yeah. She's like, so do you want to go do some comedy? You're a comedian, right? And I'm like, I couldn't think of a thing I would rather do fucking less than go up in front of the school that embarrassed me. Like it's so triggering, dude.
It's these are the things I was talking about this.
And there's some comics that do that kind of comedy, like Jeff Ross would be like, sure, no problem.
Right.
You know, guys who would do it. I'm not that kind of guy.
I mean, it also, you're right. You have to really work a room, and it's really like turning a room around because people are not ready. They don't want, that's not a good form for success ever.
But also I know, like I saw the jocks, I knew all the, and like most of the guys that I was friends with weren't even there. So it would be giving these guys a second opportunity in my grown-up life. To be like, he's not that good.
I saw him. He wasn't that funny.
Yeah, I don't even remember him. You remember that kid? Yeah, I mean, what the fuck would I do
apparently
that
for? He has like a radio show or something.
Yeah. There's that. There's that whole thing. Like, you know, you finally get something and then your parents are like, I don't know what you're doing.
I was on Veep and my mom says to me, she's like, I've been watching. I haven't seen you on the show. And I'm like, what do you mean you haven't seen? I've been on like every week this last month. And she's like, I haven't seen it. And I'm like, what? I'm so furious. I'm like, but no, but I'm on the show. And she's like, what scenes? And I'm like, well, it's like I'm in like the CBS stuff. She's like, I don't know what that is. And I go, okay, oh, what? I go, God. What scenes have you seen? She's like, what? The dog? Are you in any of the scenes with the dog? And I go, the dog? There's no dog on the show. And then I realized she was watching Madam Secretary, which is like a Tia Leone like CBS hour long, where it's like it was about a female president. Right. So my mom interpreted Veep as female president, which then became...
Can't win.
And then she was like, and I actually like that show. And I'm like, well, then she never watched Veep.
She never watched it.
No, she was like Madam Secretary.
Yeah, when you finally get to a place where you feel like you've leveled off, I remember my dad once said to me, you ought to talk to Bill Maher. He seems to know what's going on. Oh. I'm like, what about what? Like, how do they judge success?
Well, I remember my mom would always say...
That generation was Alan Alda.
Yeah.
It's like you're on a show that everybody watches. Not everybody watches anything.
I will only be successful to my parents if I'm ever on like the Kelly Ripa show. Like I feel like that, like Regis and Kathy Lee when I was like, but they're like, oh, could you ever get on Kelly Ripa? And I'm like, no, they won't book me on that. They aggressively will never book me. And I've tried so many times just because I know.
To placate your mom.
Yeah. I'm just like, I want to be on this because my grandma then can show it. Everyone can show it. And that would be the one thing that would establish.
Yeah, but you only get 4 minutes.
I don't even need to be funny. It's just to be
you don't think you do. You know, you get on there. You're like, you look nice, but they didn't let you talk.
Well, but to me, all they need to see is that I was on this thing that they liked.
Yes.
And that was, and like in a weird way, it's like they're never listening to the thing, you know?
I did Colbert a few times. My mom was, you know, she locked into that. My dad seems to think I've done something, so it's okay.
Yeah. No, my parents are, they're definitely supportive and they watch, but they never quite understand it. You know, it's like, it's
if you're not the star,
yeah,
what are you doing?
And then like the other things I'm on are too dirty, so they don't watch that. And then it's like, oh, and I was like, my mom didn't have Showtime, so she couldn't watch Black Monday. And then I go, you want me, I'll buy you a subscription. It's like, nah.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right.
So what made you, like the last time I talked to yes. you in 2010, let's start the podcast.
Now. Yes. All right.
It's great catching up. Yeah. Let's get the thing in the can here. No, but I mean, it seemed to me that when you talked about the stuff about your stepfather, and like it was very, I re-listened to it because to me it was one of these big moments on the podcast.
Yeah,
because I misjudged or assumed who you were.
Right, that was like that moment. You're like, all right, so I guess like what, you're just a happy guy. Yeah. Nothing goes wrong. I haven't listened back to it because I was like, I didn't know. You know, I was like, I just remember it so kind of clearly. Yeah. Like, yeah, it was like this, like kind of like, and it was like, but you did that thing that I feel like is a great trick of an interviewer where you're just like, nah, well, I guess that's it. You know, that's it. And it's like, you know, it's like the Columbo thing. It's like, and one more thing. Did you do this? And you're like, oh, and then you get like, you said that. You said
sound
that.
Like a pretty well-adjusted guy.
Yeah.
And you're like, no, I've got some. I'm like what? And then you're like, there's a fight. Your dads are fighting. You're punching people. You're hitting a guy's head on a fender.
Yeah. It was, you know, I think, and that was the first time that I ever really talked about it publicly. And it was interesting because, you know, we're talking here and it's casual. And if you and I were out, I would have that conversation with you. Right. I would talk to you about it. But
when did people that you know hear that and go like, Jesus Christ?
Absolutely. Because I don't talk about it. I never talk about it. Like, but if you were to have said that to me privately, I would feel comfortable saying it, but I just don't bring it up.
Right.
And then you did. And I went there, and it was this weird moment in my life, because at that point, it was this like kind of reckoning with, this is a part of my life that I don't talk about. I just don't let people in. Like, maybe a handful of people know this.
Sure.
And why am I not doing that? And I was like, oh, because my parents. I don't want my parents have created a certain reality that I am also, ascribing to. I'm like, they're going to, we don't talk about this.
That's the big question.
Right.
It's also sort of like, out of respect for them, but then you get to a point where you're like, but this is my life.
Right. I'm an adult. I have I have this thing. And I remember I went home and I was like, oh shit, I gotta call my folks, because if they hear it, or if someone says that they heard it, it's, this is the first time I've ever really talked about it. And that was you're thanked in my thank you, because that honestly started this journey for me. And again, I don't want to sound too lofty about this, but to kind of reclaim that, or at least own this part of me that I would never really talk about. And now, look, 14 years later, it's when I finally was able to kind of wrestle with it in a way that I think, do it in a healthy way.
In a funny way,
right? Like, I didn't want to write a book that felt like therapy. Right?
Yeah, where people are like, oh my God, that poor guy. Yeah, no, because like the prose is funny. And also like, the act of writing helps you process.
I think so. It was interesting, like why I wanted to, I don't even know if I, it was like that podcast that we did started a little bit of this snowball effect where I didn't know it was leading, but I felt like I needed to grasp it. And even when I started to write this book, I was like, oh, I'll just write the funny anecdotes. I'll just do the funny stuff and it'll be good. And I read those back and I was like, it doesn't feel like book worthy. It doesn't feel like this
gotta
is a book.
Got to mix in the real shit.
Right. And this is like that wrestling with this thing of like, all right, well, if I'm going to go there, I have to go there. And how do I go there? And I before I tried to sell the book or I even had an agent, I just was writing. I was like, let me just write.
Really?
I was like, let me write to see what I have.
Did you go to therapy?
Oh, yeah. I've gone to therapy. I started probably in like 2005 off and on, through now. And I think that like in the sense that this is not therapy, but I think it's a reflection of therapy.
Giving you the foundation to talk about it in a way, because, you don't do what I do. You started a podcast.
Yeah.
Right after you were on mine,
but
it's a completely entertainment driven podcast.
Right. It's not about personal stuff. We're not interviewing people. We're just watching movies. Yeah.
And also the comedic work you do isn't really.
No.
So this is like this whole other area, your private life.
Yeah. And I think I draw a line on certain things where it's like, I don't post pictures of my kids online. I try to keep my relationships, like in that way, sort of private. But there was something really interesting about telling this story, because I also felt like when I became a parent, it completely recontextualized my own childhood. Because I was like, oh, I can look at this. Like, even when I was on your show, I could tell you those stories, but I see it completely differently now. Same story, same thing. But
you had no kids.
Yeah, no kids. And I think for me, having kids like put me in the position of being a parent and thinking about what if I was in this situation as a parent, I saw this happening to my kid, what would I do?
Yeah.
And in a weird way, I think it brought up a lot of anger for me for the first time. Cause I think I was so like, oh, my parents did the best they can. They did. And I love my parents. I have a great relationship with them, but
not the stepdad,
No, but I think I wasn't looking at it or I was kind of doing the thing that my parents do, and I don't know if you can identify with this, but it's like there's this mentality of if you're you're fine. Nothing's broken. You're not dead. You're fine. Don't obsess over it.
Which just means that, in other words, like somehow you got through it.
Right.
And you're not a mess.
This man, like I had a home invasion when I was a young kid. This guy, like my stepfather, owed money to this guy. This guy came, thought my stepfather was home, and I told him that he wasn't, and then proceeded to kind of try to break in to my house. And, it heightens to this point where he's coming through the window, and I have this, like, wooden ninja sword that I had from a Halloween costume, and I'm just fucking fighting this guy who's, like, kind of like Winnie the Poohing through my window because he's, like, half in, half out. I'm like, and I'm just slapping him, and he leaves. And my mom couldn't come home. My mom was at work, and You know, so then the cops come, but he's already left, and I'm left alone in this house for like the rest of the day, like kind of frightened out of my fucking mind. Yeah. I've never understood, like, this is, yeah, home invasion, like literally, yeah. Like, and I don't, you know, I don't know what to do. And I'm telling my parents this, and they're like, oh, well, but you're okay.
Yeah.
It's fine.
And they knew the guy.
It's like, he just needed the money back, you know? And it's like, but that idea of like, when you're forcing yourself not to process anything, like, you know, my kids now, I try to do very, very much. I try to process with them. Like, even if I think it's ridiculous, we last night talked for 45 minutes because my kids thought that they might be killed by an assassin. Like, you know, like they saw this Mr. Beast video, Mr. Beast, this YouTube guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, I hired an assassin to track me down.
Yeah.
And so, and they said to me, what's an assassin, Dad? Yeah. And I was like, oh, it's like somebody you hire to kill somebody. Shouldn't have said it so cavalierly. Didn't realize what I was saying. And as they're going to bed, my youngest son is 7. He's like, could an assassin kill me?
Yeah.
And I was like, and I go, no. And then my older son's like, no, not unless someone hired him to kill you. And I was like, no. And then it's like, and you know, there's a very simple way of being like, don't worry about it. There's no such, you know, you're not going to be assassinated. But what I think I realized too is being a dad, and this is like obviously a more ridiculous situation, but it was like, you got to talk them through it because there's something underneath the assassin.
But also
too,
there has
right?
to be a general, you know, provide safety.
Right. Right. It can't just be, don't worry about it.
And also you weren't in a safe situation.
Right. Yeah.
They are.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
But you still have to like engage in that within that whole time.
Yeah.
I think I was in a way not allowed to ever process it. And it's so much so that like when we got out of that situation, it's like, and that's done. And we've put that away and we're not going to talk about it. Like I look through pictures. There's no pictures of my stepdad.
Yeah.
I can't find a single picture of him. No one ever brings him up. It's wild how removed it is. And I think when I was writing the book about this time, you get in this zone where you're like, did this happen this way? Was this the right thing? You know, and you start to question it because it's so clear to me, but no one else.
Were the pictures thrown out?
I don't know. I seriously don't know. Like, I'm like,
you went through your mom's pictures?
I mean, I don't even know if my mom keeps, I have my pictures. I have tons of pictures. I have two pictures of him. I found two pictures, one in the background. And maybe as a kid, I threw them out. I don't know. You know, it's like, I don't know what I did there because that's blocked out on some level. But I, you know, as I'm like, you know, I'm just this idea of what's in my head. So I was back in Long Island and it was towards the end of writing the book. I'm like, I'm going to drive by my house.
Yeah.
And I started driving by my house and going down. And I started to feel this thing where it's like, I've never felt this, you know, and I'm dealing with it. And I, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm over this stuff. But you start to like, everything is the same. And that was the weird thing. My area is the same. And if anything, it's shittier than I remember it. Like, I remember it a little bit better. And like, I once showed a picture of my house to a friend and they're like, oh, you live in like a trailer park. And I'm like, oh no, I didn't have a trailer park. It was like, it was nice. And it was like, you know, and I go down this block that we lived on.
Yeah.
And there's the house. It's owned by a different person.
Yeah.
Slight differences. But the one thing that stuck out to me was like, I talk about this bench. I remember this one bench and it was broken. And I see that bench fucking on the side of my house, still broken, like in a little bit of a trash heap. But that same fucking bench. And this is like, I haven't been back to the house in, I mean, honestly, probably like 30 plus years.
Yeah.
And that fucking bench was there.
Yeah.
And it was like, everything, it was like, yes, this is all like your memory of this is right. This thing. And you start to see all these things and it's like, oh yes, that the way that those doors open that way that and I got freaked out. I know the person wasn't there, you know, my stepfather wasn't in the house. And then I drove down the block to go to this 7-Eleven where these dudes tried to fucking steal my bike. Three adult men like thought I stole their son's bike and they started like chasing me around.
Yeah.
Go back to that 7-Eleven. There's that fucking bike stand where I had my bike and I'm in that. And I go back in that 7-Eleven and I go in there and there's a guy who looks like this guy wearing camo pants, knife on his belt, a shirt with the Italian flag on it and yelling about Biden in this 7-Eleven. I'm like, oh, this is my, this world has not changed. It has been in this little ecosystem that I grew up in. And that was like, you know, it's interesting because I tried very hard when I wrote this book to do two things, which is like, it's my stories. I didn't talk to anybody else.
Yeah.
I didn't let anybody read it until my wife is the only one who read it before it went out. And I really didn't want to, I was respectful of my parents because I can tell if it was you and me privately, I would tell you,
yeah,
I think this about this, and I think that about this, and here's a little backstory. And here's But I'm like, I'm not telling the backstory of my parents. I was like, because I was like, I'm just going to tell the story of me. And that was the way that I think I came to a satisfying, like, middle ground.
Right.
It's my story. Their characters in it. I may characterize them in a way that they agree with or they don't, but I'm not trying to tell their, I'm not telling their story.
Sure.
And that actually has given me some solace. And then I gave them the book and 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and I'm like, cause I didn't want them to read the book and then make, ask me to make changes. I wouldn't want to do that. And it was interesting to see their reactions.
What they, you know, what were they?
Well, my mom.
Was there stuff in there like, we didn't know that?
No. They knew everything. Like, and that's the thing, but they wouldn't. But seeing it in black and white, I think is different, right? You know?
Sure.
And seeing it through my eyes.
Yeah.
And it was funny because my mom's reaction was, I wish you would have said X, Y, and Z. I wish you went deeper. I wish you told this story and that and this. And I'm like, well, that's not my story to tell. I mean, that's your story. And that's, and I think my mom was looking at it a little bit in a way of, like, not a, like, I'm going to finally tell the truth and I'm going to burn these people who got me.
Sure.
And I think that that was a thing I was trying to be aware of too. Like, this is not a burn book. I'm not trying to you know, like roast anybody. Even Hunter, this guy who's my stepfather. I'm not trying to roast that guy. I'm trying to be like, I'm just talking about him. He's a character in this thing. And my, and then my, and my dad had an interesting reaction because I gave him the book and he, you know, and he wrote, I, as he was leaving my house to go on a plane to go back to New York, I said, here's a book.
Yeah.
So I knew he was going to read it on the plane. And the plane lands and he sends me a text and he's like, I really love the book. And I wanna talk to you about this thing. And I go, great. And we have not talked yet, but he sent me a text, which made me laugh. Cause I was like, it's still to a certain extent what I'm talking about here. It's like, there wasn't a phone call to be like, hey, but I can also tell he's wrestling with stuff right now because he sends me texts about basketball nonstop. I haven't texted my dad about basketball, I don't know, whatever. But now every day, twice or three times a day, we're talking about basketball.
Yeah.
Basketball.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, he's working through something now too. You know, and we will sit down and talk. I said to him, let me just finish this press tour. I want to be done with, I want to have that conversation. I just can't, I'm already talking about this stuff and it's crazy because you're selling a part of your life in a weird way. Yeah. And it's like, and it's emotional, it's hard. And I've talked to some people and it's, there's emotions that everyone kind of brings to it. And I was like, can we just give me like 2 more weeks and then we'll talk. So
you'll find out.
We'll see. But I did talk to my dad multiple times. And I wonder if, in a weird way, putting it in black and white was easier because I think when you talk to somebody and you say like you hurt me or you weren't there for me, you get defensive immediately, right?
Sure.
This idea of like, oh no, wait, hold on, I got, and it's like it's just there in print, and you have to just
it's done,
right?
Like the thing about it is, it's like, you know, whatever their story is or whatever their reaction is, it's not going to make it into print.
Right. Exactly, that's it, and you know, maybe that will be another part of this story, but that's the story that it is now. And it's like, part of it is, in many respects, like, I don't need anything from my parents.
Right.
I love them. I have a great relationship with them, but I don't need, like, they're not going to provide any more closure for me.
Sure.
I think you have to do that work yourself.
I know. That's the lifetime work.
Yeah.
And anytime you feel that weird, you know, vacuum of insecurity, it's where they drop the ball and you've got to step in.
I've had this vision. I read this book. You know, I've read books. I do therapy. I've done a lot of, you know, whatever, some LA stuff. And the image that always comes back to me, and I think about it all the time now, is when we're reacting in a way that is intense, or you get into a fight with somebody, or and you're like, oh, why did I get so mad like that? I think of this version of like, that is the little version of you, like this little, you know, the hurt person, and you are kind of standing behind that person. And I always think I have to, like, when I'm in that moment, I have to like take that little person and put them behind me and stand in front of me.
Yeah,
I'm an adult now. I get this. I know.
That person, like, if you're still having the emotional reaction of anger as being emotionally 11, it's now coming out of a 50-year-old.
Right. And it's chaotic.
It's scary.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know. My anger is really kind of diminished. I tend to cry more than yell.
Right.
Now.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
I couldn't cry for years.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. Like, I used to cry a lot.
Yeah.
Then there was like this period of time where it just like, it felt too vulnerable to cry. And now trying to, and again, being a parent, going through certain things, sure. You start to like, it kind of like just kickstarted those emotions in a good way.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a thing, and maybe you had this when, I only had like an on-off switch. It was like anger, not angry.
Yeah.
You know, or almost like passive fucking
right,
anger.
But I didn't have control of the switch a lot.
Neither did I.
Yeah.
And now I feel like, if anything, I have a dial. Sometimes it's going to go to 10.
Yeah.
And that's it. Like, I'm not saying I'm like, oh, I'm perfect. But at least I understand that I can go to a 2. I can go to a 4. I can go to an 8. Sure. You know, I can ride a dial. But I didn't have that control. Yeah. It would just be fucking ferocious. And it would come out against, you know, like I wouldn't even vocalize it, but I'd be fucking mad. And, you know, you get this thing. It's like, I don't want to be taken advantage of. I don't want to be lied to. I don't want to be this. And that kind of shit. That I think has been the interesting thing for me is, and still wrestling with all of that. Like, how are you present? How are you active? How are you a person that is true to yourself? And if part of that truth is anger, that's okay too. It's like, you know, I think when I started dating my wife, it was an experiment for me to do something different.
Yeah.
Because I felt like I was too passive in relationships. I felt like I was like,
Just the first date you yelled at her?
I was like, get the fuck out of here. But you know what it was? Like, I don't know if you felt like this. You're maybe different than me, you know? But my thing of like with relationships early on was like, I just don't want to rock the boat. Maybe that's a thing about coming up in a chaos.
Yeah.
It was like, I don't want to be responsible. I'm actually going to try to calm everybody, calm it all down. And so if you know, you want to go to this place, great. I'll go to that place. You know, if you, it could be any little bit, not even just like a fight.
I'm more like that now. Because I want to make compromises. But initially, I was always threatened by people's emotions in terms of, you know, I always felt like, you're fucking with me.
Right.
Or, you know, you're manipulating me. What the fuck does that mean? What are you talking about?
I remember laying in bed with a girl I was dating for a while. And she said, I love you. And I was like, no, you don't. It was just like, of course she does it. There's no way.
Yeah, I've used that line. It's not a great line.
No, it's terrible. It's a terrible lie. But you know, I don't know if I told you this, but this is the moment that like opened it up for me, like that started me to even be able to talk about it on your show.
Yeah.
I was dating this girl and it was going bad. And we decided, let's go to couples therapy, which I got to say, I think when you're dating and you're going to couples therapy, I'm like, what are we trying to do here?
Well, I did a joke once where I think that a good second date is couples therapy.
Get ahead of it. Like, just get ahead of it right away. So we, you know, but it's not going well. And it's like, what are we waiting for from this person to like fix it? It's like, it's going south. And it went south. And she left. And the therapist said to me, she's like, would you want to stay?
Yeah.
And I was against therapy because when I was younger, we had a therapist, a family therapist. We brought Hunter and everyone's there. And, you know, she told us all, like, if he does this again, I'm going to call people. We're going to take care of it. You know, a week passes, he does it again, acts up again, to tell her. And she's like, okay, one more time.
Yeah. Right.
You know? And it's like, and I'm like, fuck therapy. This is bullshit. And
they're not keeping me safe.
Yeah. They're not doing anything. So, but I stayed with this woman. And I thought there was like this, this therapist. And I thought like, in a way, it's my passivity going like, if I stay, then she's going to actually know that I was like the better person in this relationship.
Sure.
You know, I'm willing to do the work. She wasn't willing to do the work. And you know, when we started talking, it started off like that. Just me trying to prove to her, like, just so you know, I was.
Yeah, yeah.
And she, in the middle of a session, she like, from her, like under her chair, pulls out this yellow wiffle ball bat. And I don't know what's going on. And she's like, here, beat up that couch. I want you to hit that couch. I want you to like scream at that couch. And I'm already doing comedy at this point. And I'm like, no, I'm gonna fucking hit a couch. I feel like it's stupid. I'm not gonna hit it. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm mad. You know, but I'm like, she's like, no, keep on doing it. Keep on doing it. And it was this moment.
You got a yes and, Paul.
Yeah, I know. But you know what, like these moments, and this is some of the best things I've done in life. I've been when I acknowledge if I was to see someone doing this or if I heard the story, I would make fun of this person.
Right, sure.
And, but I have to also be like, you know what? Just fucking do it.
Yeah.
And I have to like kind of separate the two versions of myself. I did this thing recently and I was like, if I saw this, I would be making, but the minute I gave over to it, it was worthwhile. Because I think that's an automatic defensive system that we have as comedians. Like, we're just going to be like, I'm not going to be vulnerable. Like, and so I'm using that fucking bat. And it's not really working because I'm not committing to it. But she saw something that I never saw myself, which was like I was holding in anger. Because I basically went from being a super angry person to I have no anger. I'm shutting it off. And that's it. And then occasionally I would rage.
Yeah.
But it would be like, it would be like a, it would almost be like going on a bender. It's like, I don't drink anymore. But now I was like, ah. And then, And she saw that thing. And that's what she wanted me to do. Like, be angry with this fucking bat. And it took a long time for me to start to trust that I could even be a little bit angry or like even let that out. And that was like the beginning of, I think like, and I wouldn't know it then. And I think I look back on it now and go, I think that was the beginning of like the healing process.
Oh, she just did, like, you know, did good.
She did good.
And you
she,
talk about the anger in the book.
Oh yeah. I talk about the anger a lot because it's like, that was the thing. I talk about this idea of like being the Hulk, because when I got a little bit older with Hunter, my stepfather, I realized I could fight back.
Yeah.
And then when you realize you could fight back, I had some power. But then what I also did was open myself up to fucking harder fights. You know, like it was like now, like before it was like I'd call mercy, it would be over, right? And now it was like, okay, you're going to throw that at my head. I'm going to fucking throw this at you. And then, and I'm going to throw you into this wall. Like, and we're both going at it. I remember like just wanting to rip his hair plugs out. I knew he had hair plugs. I was like, and I was just always trying to grab at those, you know. It was violent and it was intense. But what happened was then if someone did something like this, and we talked about that during the show, like where I felt slighted, I felt, at all disregarded, I'd fucking go nuts and beat, fucking pummel a kid's face into a fender, you know. And that was this middle ground of going, oh, I don't want to be this man. I'm getting to be this man. I was like, literally a kid came over to my house to fight me. It's like, hey, come kick your ass. I'll see you in 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I'm like, all right. and like this kid came to my house and we're walking out to the back. And I just like, I really had this moment where I was like, the fuck am I doing? I'm a senior in high school getting ready to fight behind in the woods behind my house. And I saw myself as that guy, as this guy, because Hunter would come home with a fucking arm in a sling and, and fighting on, at this thing. And I realized in that moment I could de-escalate it. I was like, I just apologized. I'm like, hey man, I'm sorry. And I almost started to cry in saying I'm sorry. And I think he thinks like, oh, this fucking pussy, he's crying.
Sure.
But it was like a release of like, I'm calling mercy again. So then in a weird way, I'm going back to like a child who's like letting somebody win.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to balance it. And then from that moment on, I was like, I'm shutting it off. I'm not going to be this person. I'm going to be a nice guy. I'm not going to be angry. And that also is not good. I mean, it's not good to be stepped on or passive, or you're just not, you shut off a part of yourself.
Yeah, but sometimes it's self-protection, and if you cause enough pain, you you at least know you don't want to do that.
Right.
And so it's tricky to sort of, process the anger or the sadness or whatever it is. But, really, if you're an angry person, usually you get to a point where you like you've caused pain,
right?
And you've got to not do that.
Well, and I think you're right. So it's like, how do you do it? And it's like, and I didn't have the tools to know any other way than just not do it, right? Which is like, which is not healing.
But
it.
That's
it's just
part
like putting
of it. Yeah, I mean, it's a good start,
right? It's something. It's like I'm putting it in a box. I think, but also,
it's making me wonder what I've done with mine. Because the other night I had a conversation with my opener about somebody who I had strong opinions about. That were deep. They weren't just sort of, I don't like that person's work.
Yeah.
I felt, that this person was a toxic, fucked up person.
Yeah.
And my tone changed to the point where the person I was talking to was like, whoa, wow.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. And I tried, I said, I want to talk about that person. She's like, why? And then I'm like, and then it just came up and it was like, wow, that guy's still in there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and look,
sometimes he comes out on stage.
I mean, like I've had those moments too. Like I've done scenes where I'm like, I can tap into that because it's there, you know, it's like, but it used to feel like it was right under the surface. Now I'm like, I have that thing, but yeah, it comes up, and that's what I'm saying. I'm like, I'm not saying it's gone. It's, yeah. But it's, I understand levels to
sure,
it.
Yeah. But, and also, you know where it's coming from, and you don't have to react as the kid.
Do you have trouble apologizing?
No, not okay. Really.
I couldn't apologize for.
Well, it depends.
Okay. Cause like for me, it was like, if I apologized, I'm saying, you're right, I hurt you. And again, that's like, but for me, like being this thing of like, I have no problem apologizing. But for a long time, I didn't want to apologize. Because if I apologize, I'm admitting that I fucked up. And I've hurt you and I've upset the balance. And I never didn't mean to do that. I didn't want to hurt you. I didn't want, you know, it's like you made me or this, you know, it's like, sure. It's a weird thing.
I think when you're sober and you do a little bit of work, you can kind of apologize in a way that it's really just taking responsibility.
Right.
For, you know, what may or may not have happened. It could just be in your fucking head.
Right.
You know, a lot of times you apologize to people who are like, I didn't know what you're talking about.
And I also think what I learned with apologies too is like, who cares? Like, there's no right or wrong. Like if you say, hey man, you fucking hurt my feelings.
Yeah.
I can't tell you, no, you're wrong. Like if your feelings are hurt,
yeah.
Even if you misinterpreted what I said or
sure.
Did, but it was like, I felt so like... I felt like that was also painting me as a bad person. Like if I hurt your feelings, I made a mistake.
Avoiding that.
Yeah. And I don't know. So it's like, there's all these like little things. And so I feel like I'm very apologetic with my kids. You know, I make mistakes with my kids all the time, but like, I'm going to sit there and be like, hey, I'm so sorry I did that to you. I didn't mean to do that to you. And that's wrong. And I think it's like, we start to have this like more open dialogue.
No, it's important. You know, like I had a thing with a guy who I was friends with and he just shut me out. And, you know, he had this idea about something and he just wouldn't talk to me and it was driving me nuts. I'm like, you know, at least just give me the opportunity to take responsibility for something or at least know what the hell you're thinking about.
Yeah.
And then like, it just got, you know, we ended up at the same party and, you know, and he's like, you want to know? And then he laid it out and I'm like, well, first of all, that thing you're thinking happened, that didn't happen.
Right.
It was not a real thing.
Right.
But if you still feel the way you feel, I get it, and I appreciate you telling me that, and I'm sorry. And I got emotional. I was tearing up and shit because, you know, we were friends. And it was just sort of like, it's also that moment in contrition or knowing what's going on where you realize you have no control over other people. And you just have to, you know, take the hit.
Yeah, and it's... It's better. Actually, you release stuff more by just, taking the hit, being there, having that conversation. Because I also think so much of this shit happens in darkness, right? Like you don't, it's like, they're not thinking it. It didn't happen or it did happen and you're not going to talk to that person directly. And then it becomes this like weird thing where it just starts to metastasize.
Yeah.
And then you're like, and then it's like, I don't talk to that person. Fuck that person. It's like, because it's like you've built a inner relationship of fighting.
Yeah.
I try to catch myself in it and, you know, and there will always be a person
or two.
A thing. Oh, yeah. Right. Or these things that just kind of sneak up and get you.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like, But I think it's like a lifelong process.
Sure.
I mean,
and it's like, it's also like contrary action and, you know, not hitting send and all that shit.
Yeah. Well, pause. My wife walks away a lot and it's for her mental health to be like, I need to stop this. And I have a hard time because I think that
obviously. Yeah, it's the worst. It's like, what are you talking about?
Right. It's like, I want to continue. And it's like, and in the light of day, like after like an hour, you're like, oh yeah, let's call. Why was I intent on finishing it? Right? Like, it's like, but it is this thing of like, I want to win or I want to, you know, and it's like, and that's the, and it's like, and I will fall into that trap and I will, you know, make that mistake and I'm not infallible in that at all. But I also think too, it's like, I had my friend, he was like, why you go to therapy?
Yeah.
And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you go to therapy, you're not going to be funny. And I'm like, no, that's not, I don't think how it works. In a weird way, I think when you do work on yourself, you actually are more well-rounded. You understand yourself, so you can actually bring more of yourself.
Totally. Yeah.
I think about that monologue that you did in Sort of Trust.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's a beautiful, it's you can't take your eyes off it, you know, but that's also informed by, I think, your life, right?
Sure.
You know, it's like it's something that is that you can touch, but if you didn't go to certain places or do certain things, I don't know if you could have done that and then that justice in that same way. I don't know.
Maybe No, totally. It was like it was, you know, it wasn't my life, but it was parts of it.
Right. That's it's like not like,
and I knew the life I was talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd seen enough of that life and experienced enough with what I was talking about in terms of my own, you know, dreams or whatever. Yeah, it was that was an interesting thing, that monologue.
It's, I think that those are the moments that we all get into and we connect with, and it's way more interesting on a certain level. You know, for people who don't know this, and like this is now going to be out, and this is now going to be part of, I don't own this anymore, right?
Yeah.
Like it's like, it is
You've
now,
released it.
I've released it. And it's like, and people say, oh, is it cathartic? I'm like, it's not cathartic because I've made peace with it. Now it's in a book, but now everybody will know it. But it is interesting now, like, it's like, oh, I'm sharing this thing that now people will have, or whoever reads it will have this thing, you know, that will have this knowledge about me, you know? And that's like a little bit scary.
Mm.
But at the same time, it's the stuff that I know I respond to. And it could be anything. It could be that monologue. Okay, go ahead.
But yeah, but the thing about it is like you mixed it up. You mix it up well.
Right.
So, you know, we're talking seriously about anger and you talk about, you know, the stepfather. You talk about ADHD and you talk about, you know, struggles in you know, relationship. But there's like that thing that happened to you in Times Square.
Yeah.
The exact same thing happened to me.
Oh my gosh, I love that. That's hilarious.
That, like, you know, I used to go to my grandmother's, take the bus in from Jersey to Port Authority when I was like 13. You know, and just like, can we drink? I remember going in there when I was in high school. I brought my buddy in. We got platform shoes. We were just going to go have a beer somewhere. And it was so ridiculous because we just end up at like Hamburger Harry's or whatever the fucking place was. You know, and they served us. We're like, we did it. And then you end up, and then some guy came up to us and tried to scam us in Times Square. Like, I'll show you. It was about guitars. You want to buy a guitar? I say we were looking at guitar shops. And we followed this guy for a while. And we're like, we got to go.
Yeah, this is it. Like, these are moments. And that's true. Like, that moment of being in 42nd Street and thinking you're an adult. And then also realizing, like, when you look back, like, oh, we were kids. Like, we weren't fooling anyone. I actually found my fake ID from that day that I had. And I was like looking at it. I was like, oh, there's no one thought we were 21. Yeah. Like, and this is
and
hilarious.
Then going into the sex club, that was great. And also the thing about that first time you saw UCB. I mean, there's a lot of, it's not all heavy.
No. The book is like, and that's the intention. That's the joyful recollections of trauma. Like, we are talking about the heavier stuff. It's like, it is, to me, what I wanted to do is tell an entertaining book. I had like, that's the number one thing. It's like a tightrope walk on a tightrope. Like, I'm going to tell something real. I'm not going to undercut that thing, but it's also going to be fun to read. Like I said, it's not therapy. It's fun. This is like a book that has insane fun stories and it has a connective tissue to it, but it's not like, it's not a bummer. This is not like Angela's Ashes.
No, not at all. It's great. So, yeah. It's great. You did a great job, buddy.
You're lovely to say it, and I appreciate you having me back on. But I did, it was interesting in going back to just think about, this was like you and this show 10 years or 14 years ago was a pivotal moment in just starting to talk about it in a way that was like, oh, I can talk about this.
I have a life. I can talk about.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I helped out. And then we started podcasts
pretty
soon after. And now we've been in this game. We were at some of the original modern podcasters.
I always say that you know, when you are the OG and like, I know we've been doing How Did This Get Made for 14 years.
Dude, it's fucking nuts.
It's nuts. And I love it. And I mean, how do you feel? 800 episodes in. I was episode 127. This is what, 850 now? You're like,
we're like 1600. We do two a week.
1600. Oh my God. That's amazing. Oh
well,
my
you know God. What? You know, the one thing we couldn't have imagined, and certain 1600. I don't know that we were really gunning for it, but it worked out, buddy.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's the thing. Like, people are like, well, how do I get into podcasts? I'm like, when I started this thing, there was no, you had to tell people what a podcast was.
Yeah. And there was no real way to make money.
Yeah. And the first 7 years, we didn't make money.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it was just crazy. And the world grew around us. And now we've made a monster.
And it's hilarious to watch people.
Are you still all audio or you do video?
Audio. And I appreciate that's what I appreciate about you guys. Like, I'm like, I love it because it's like, I think it's also more personal. It's better. I like it. I like it in my ear. It's like you find the people you want to listen to. It's like, and it was great.
Yeah, you can do other things. And
yeah.
Well, that's good, man.
No, I love it. And I love that you're having some people back on it. Joe Mandy was great to have back on. It was so fun. But yeah, it's been like, I mean, it's wild. And, you know, I think about you all the time because you had Obama in your garage.
Yeah,
2016. Right. And now all of a sudden, you know, Biden's on fucking Howard Stern and all this other stuff. You know, it's like, it's wild. But like those things like that, I do believe is the reason why Biden goes on Stern.
Of course. It was because, you know, we were there and there were podcasters before me and you and there were people around, but it was still not normalized in any way. Most older people and most people in general was not part of their regular listening. They didn't know how to get it. And then this thing built up around us. And now you look around and like, I'm not resentful. I'm grateful that it worked out for me, but there is part of me that's sort of like, I'm kind of responsible.
Well, you have to be in that podcast Hall of Fame. You got to be in that Mount Rushmore of the thing.
We are.
You know, you're like, look, just by the fact of doing it more than a decade, I think like anyone who can do that, because it's like during the pandemic, everyone who started the podcast, and it's like, I said to people, when people ask me like, what do you do? Yeah. I'm like, well, I just say it like this, just do something that you want to do more of, because truly in success, the only thing that's going to happen is more.
Yeah.
Do more podcasts. It's like, and that's it.
They come and go. I can't, like, if digital garbage was visible, it would be its own planet.
I know. It's like, it's so, but I don't know what people expect. Like, I did 7 episodes and I'm not Joe Rogan, so fuck it.
And now it's impossible to break in.
Oh, yeah.
And even the things that you think are breaking through are not.
No.
Because, people put money in them now.
Well, and the other thing, too, is like you have to then tell everybody, hey, slot out one of those things that you listen to. Like, all right, I listen to 2 Marins a week. I listen to
That's
this.
That's right.
Like,
yeah. How much time do people have?
It's like, which one am I going to knock out? And you, if you put in this much time, it's like, well, I want to spend time with my friends, that my ear friends.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. You're not. Yeah. It's hard to like find a slot on the
and
mantle.
Everybody's fighting for the same heads.
Yeah.
And people only have a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
But we're doing all right.
Yeah, we do it.
All right.
I love it.
Thanks. So good talking to you.
You too.
Well, that's it. I'm glad he's doing better and still very much a great guy. I like Paul, and I thought that was a good talk. His book, Joyful Recollections of Trauma, is available now. His podcasts are available wherever you get podcasts. Those would be How Did This Get Made and Unspooled.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Haben Sie das Gefühl, dass Ihre Werbung ins Leere geht? Mit LinkedIn Ads erreichen Sie die richtigen EntscheiderInnen. Gefiltert nach Branche, Firmenname, Karrierestufe, Kenntnissen und, habe ich schon Jobbezeichnung gesagt? Füllen Sie die Leere und erreichen Sie die richtigen mit LinkedIn Ads. Investieren Sie 200 Euro in Ihre erste LinkedIn-Ads-Kampagne und erhalten Sie 200 Euro Guthaben für die nächste. Einfach auf linkedin.com/Aktion. Es gelten die allgemeinen Geschäftsbedingungen.
Okay, for you Full Marin subscribers, you'll get more of my conversation with Paul Scheer tomorrow. Here's a little preview.
I get the thing where people assume that I am Andre from the league sometimes.
And, yeah.
You know, so they'll come up and they'll yell things that are sometimes inappropriate. Like there's a joke on the show where my character was like, there's a porn based on my character called like Andre No Dick or something like that. And people come up like that. Like, hey, no, Dr. No Dick.
Yeah.
But I'm also with my kids and I'm like, oh, that's weird, you know. You know, like, the kids are like, what's a dick? Yeah, you know, I'm like, okay, well.
That's up tomorrow for Full Marin subscribers. You can get bonus episodes twice a week, plus every episode of WTF ad-free. Just go to the link in the episode description to sign up, or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. Here's some guitar I just did. Monkey and La Fonda, cat angels everywhere.